I didn't get started making kombucha because I thought I was going to get rich. I didn't start making kombucha because I thought it was the best tasting thing on the planet. I started making kombucha because I wanted it to help people, and I wanted to be the protector of that. Because, you know, I'm truly fearful that if we're not careful, what's going to stop kombucha from becoming a cold brew coffee or a cold pressed juice or a coconut water?
From 2003 Media, this is The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. Welcome to the program.
My name is GT Dave. I am the founder and CEO of GT's Living Foods.
Today on the show, I'm thrilled to have a conversation with GT Dave. All right, so this is GT Dave. First name GT, last name Dave. And GT is an entrepreneur that you may or may not be familiar with. But before we get into GT and his company, here's a bit of context. On this show, you're used to hearing conversations with tech and media entrepreneurs, investors, and thinkers. The types of people who've raised some money and find product market fit and then scale their software company in the process. However, today on the show, we're going to mix that up. Because GT is not a tech entrepreneur, he's far from it. He's a beverage entrepreneur, he's the king of kombucha. Furthermore, he's the founder of GT's Living Foods, which controls roughly 40% of the US kombucha market. And unlike many episodes of the show, GT has raised a whopping $0 in investment. GT dropped out of high school when he was a teenager and started GT's Living Foods back in the late 90s. And as a result, I was thrilled to talk to GT, who is based in Los Angeles. He shared some amazing stories about his introduction to kombucha and how that ultimately led him to introduce kombucha into the Western market. All of that is right ahead on the program. My conversation with GT Dave starts now. Walk me through the first time you tried kombucha. Do you remember that time?
I do remember that time. So the first time I tried kombucha was in the early 90s. I technically first was introduced to it by witnessing my father come home from work and carrying a rubbery circular disc that was kind of sloshing around in a Ziploc bag. And that's when he held it up with a big smile on his face. And he said to me and my brothers, "Look, boys, we're going to make kombucha tomorrow." And so that was the first time I had ever heard the word kombucha. Shortly after that, I was told that it was this Manchurian mushroom that had been consumed for a very long time in Manchuria, China. And those that consumed it had lived into their hundreds. And so then my first experience with kombucha was, of course, that fateful first sip, which I think I spit it out, to be honest, because it was nothing that I had ever experienced before. It was sour and tart and even vinegary to my very Western palate. It shocked me. And that's when I told my parents, I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I'll pass on this one."
How long did it take you for you to come around and for you to start to enjoy the drink? And I ask this because I want to get to this later on, but I feel that when introducing kombucha to a new market, like the Western market, there's a little bit of a adjustment phase, let's just say. It is unlike a pop or unlike a iced tea. It's a very unique drink. So how long did it take you for you to come around?
I mean, it took me a good 2 years, and it honestly wasn't even the fact that I got accustomed to how kombucha tasted. It was really because it helped my mom with her breast cancer. That, you know, the long of the short is, as I said, my mother and my father had been drinking it and loving it and really not knowing why it was healthy, but they knew it was healthy. But when my mother had the fateful diagnosis of breast cancer, and the doctor's kind of diagnosis of it was initially very bleak, and then they kind of did a 180 and said, "Okay, we're actually wrong. Your cancer is in a dormant state. It has not metastasized." And that's when they started to ask a series of questions, which out of those questions came kombucha, and that it was this unusual and unique thing that my mother had incorporated into her diet in the last couple of years. So it was the doctors that kind of signaled to my mother and my father that this kombucha was perhaps something very special and they should continue to drink it. So that was kind of my cue to be like, okay, maybe I need to give it another chance. And so I started to drink it myself. And I was just barely a teenager at the time. I was 15 years old. So it's very rare that, and this is coming from experience, it would be very rare that I'd eat or drink something that my parents would give me that immediately changed my physical feeling. I mean, I was raised vegetarian, so I certainly was not foreign to healthy living and healthy eating, but kombucha really gave me that jolt of energy. And within a month, I fell in love because I noticed, but keep in mind, still not in love with the flavor. I fell in love with how it made me feel, my digestive health, my immune health, overall well-being. And then what's interesting, and this is usually like after the 30 days, you actually start to enjoy the way it tastes. And so I guess, so the quick answer is 2 years and 1 month.
So this is interesting. And I think your mother's story is a phenomenal launching pad to kind of the health side of this whole story. But this is the 90s that we're talking. Kombucha is not, you know, today it's mainstream, and that's have a large part in that. But it was not mainstream back then. And so when these doctors are essentially doing an investigation to what your mother is consuming, are they, and you say kombucha, like that, I have to imagine they weren't like, oh, yeah. Oh, we know what that is, right? It's a totally foreign liquid.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so again, it wasn't the word or name kombucha that kind of perked their ears. It was when my mother described it as this fermented tea that she had been consuming. And I think perhaps the fermentation was a cue to them that, okay, maybe this is something that has, and back then, to your point, even the word probiotic really wasn't in people's vocabulary. And I don't even recall it being perhaps even the doctor's vocabulary. But I think what they, and again, as we all know, even today, and certainly back then, doctors are so reluctant to embrace anything that's natural, right? Because they're kind of, unfortunately, programmed to be these legalized drug pushers where everything is prescription, prescription, right. Prescription. Yeah. Yeah. So even with that, the doctors still said that, hey, whatever this Manchurian mushroom fermented tea is, if it's making you feel great, we recommend that you stay on it because your condition is miraculous. That was kind of their informal recommendation, if you will. I think the best that you can get from doctors, at least at that time.
What was the period of time when you decided that this would be something that not just worth drinking for you and your family, but worth commercializing and worth actually building a company around?
Well, it's really interesting because it really was a culmination of events, right? So the one that I just described is the fact that these doctors suggested that kombucha was something so powerful that it could have perhaps improved my mother's health, her resilience and resistance to the cancer. So that clearly was a big moment. But then you kind of dovetail that with other experiences that were going on at the time, where, as I said, because my parents had been making and drinking kombucha for the last couple of years, many things that my parents fell in love with, they would really talk about it. They became evangelists for it. And they would turn people on to kombucha, whether they would serve them kombucha in glass flutes when we would have guests over, or they would hand and give away actual culture so people could make it. And so what I noticed in those two similar yet different scenarios is those that were able to drink the kombucha loved it. They had a similar reaction to what I described earlier. Is it like, it was this eye-opening, just like wow moment that I think we all were so surprised to experience and so rarely felt. And then when we gave people cultures, that's when I noticed that, again, these are people with resources and education and all of that. 9 out of 10 times, if not 10 out of 10 times, they came back and said, wow, I couldn't do that. My batch came out weird. My mother culture didn't have a baby culture. I got mold. So there was all these kind of challenges that I was witnessing. And so that really was my signal, if you will, to say, okay, so I have this incredible thing called kombucha that's been in my household for the last 2 years. It's potentially helped my mother. People resonate with it when they can drink it, but they don't like making it because they can't really make it. How do I solve that problem? And so for me, it was like, well, I'll do it. And, you know, I was at a really interesting point in my life. I was, as I said earlier, just a teenager. So, and I had just dropped out of high school, to be honest. And so I really had, the sky was the limit, so to speak, when it comes to what I could devote my time and energy to. So that was the beginning of my mission.
Was the dropping out of high school part completely unrelated, or did it have some corresponding effect in regards to your decision to start this company?
Well, yes to both, right? So what happened was, the catalyst for leaving high school is I was unhappy and I was going nowhere fast, as they say. I was a young gay boy caught up in the bullying, call it web, that happens in high school sometimes. And I wanted out. So that certainly was the catalyst for that. Kombucha in the background was happening. So all those things that I described were going on. And then it wasn't until I had this moment where I had decided to drop out of high school, take my GED and start City College because I wanted to be with people who genuinely wanted to do something with their life versus being forced to. And so then when kombucha became this opportunity and I kind of was doing the math, I was like, all right, well, you know, I'm out of school, you know, compared to my peers. So I'm technically ahead. I'm in City College. I'm enjoying this new academic world that I'm experiencing. Cause by the way, I was also taking a couple of business classes, which I discovered quickly that I kind of had a knack for. And I was like, well, why don't I perhaps pause on all this, pursue this, you know, kombucha opportunity, which to me wasn't really a business. It was really this opportunity to do something that I really loved. And I thought, you know, other people would enjoy and benefit from. And what I learned in my first two business classes at SMC is that a lot of times the best businessmen learn hands-on. And I was like, maybe this is my hands-on, you know, session. And rather A, it'll take off and I'll, you know, be thrilled because I'm doing something I love and hopefully something that's making the world a better place, as you say, or, you know, or it doesn't go very far and I have a lot of knowledge and lessons that I could apply to when I go back to school and when I explore my next endeavor. So it really was a win-win. Mm-hmm. So no risk.
No risk. And that's a great way to look at it. I think that experience part is kind of the key, like learning either way. So was the ambition from day one, though, like let's say that's day one, you're starting this company, was the ambition to build a meaningful company? Or were you thinking, you know, this is actually something that I can sell to my friends and family friends and have a good business? I guess my question is, which direction were you leaning towards in terms of your expectation when, you know, pausing your formal education, let's call it?
Yeah, I mean, I've given this analogy before, so forgive me, but it really was like a birthing experience, to be honest, right? It's like I was given this opportunity to give birth to this form of life that I felt was really special and I felt could benefit the world. And I saw myself as a steward of that, you know, opportunity. And so it was less financial. I think the only kind of selfish aspect of, you know, kind of deciding that I'm going to do this and, you know, kind of pursue it effortlessly or fearlessly was that I wanted to change my world, right? Because as I said earlier, is I was unhappy and didn't really like the course that I was currently on, which felt somewhat, you know, somewhat forced upon people that age. And so I was like, maybe I can pave my own path. And so this was an opportunity to do that. And then that, again, dovetailing with the fact that this was something that I thought could do a lot of good, was really the impetus and the driving force behind it. It really wasn't a business. Now, certainly I understood that the business aspect was important, so I was always very cognizant of that.
So this is a question I've been thinking a lot about pre-interview, which is a lot of the folks I have on the program are in the world of technology. And in technology, if you have an idea for a product and you decide to build it, you can program it and launch it and build a minimum viable product and see how that goes. There are really no crazy costs involved with most tech businesses. However, if you're building or creating a product that is an actual drink, there are a lot more things to think about, moving parts that require physical elements, including the actual product itself, but also like making sure your drink complies with health guidelines in various regions, etc. Like it's a little more complicated. So how do you go from, you know, making kombucha for you and your friends is one thing, but actually making it and bottling it and then eventually distributing it all over North America, that's a very daunting task. And obviously that didn't happen overnight, but walk me through the early steps, the early inception, the pillars you put in place that became helpful when you were scaling the company.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, you're right. It starts off as making it for my family and for my friends and then wanting to scale that. Now, because again, I was and continue to be very obsessive with quality. At no point was it even a thought to, okay, how can I cut corners to make this faster and cheaper, which unfortunately is kind of—
You were not McDonald's, in other words.
I was not McDonald's. I was not Coke. I was not a lot of those companies. In fact, I was super cognizant of how I needed to stay away from that. So anything that even signaled or suggested it was a cutting of a corner, I was completely opposed to. So anyway, back to your question. So to take it from making it from family and friends, then to making it commercially, in my mind at the time, wasn't that much different. Because again, when you make something for family or friends, you're doing it yourself, you're crafting it with love, it's a personal expression, it's a gift you're sharing. Candidly, when I went to sell it at Air One, which is my first health food store here in Los Angeles, the approach was no different. The only thing that you could technically argue that was different is I took this art and tried to turn it into a science. Because in my mind, if I'm going to really commit to something, I need to professionalize it. And so instead of like making a batch here and there, I'd make a batch every single day. I'd have this routine that 7 days a week, I'd get up, I'd brew, I'd ferment, I'd bottle, and then I would deliver. So even when I just had my one store, which was Air One, I treated it as if I was nationwide. Because to me, every next step was a big step and I didn't really want to F it up. And so I went at it with that diligence and precision, but still with the thoughtfulness and love that I did when I was making it for friends. So hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that makes sense. And so in this, but you were making it by hand, and were you doing this in at home? Was there some kitchen space that you rented?
Well, for the first 2 years, I made it at home, and which was interesting. It was a blessing and a curse. So the curse is that I had to navigate how to make this product and kombucha in a household filled with brothers and parents even animals. And then the blessing was, is I clearly had no overhead, and, you know, I didn't have to pay for the cost that I think a lot of entrepreneurs are faced up front, which I think a lot of times can freak them out because they immediately have, rather it's a debt or they have some kind of overhead that they're worried about. If I don't meet X amount of sales, I'm going to be in the red and then continue to get in the red. And that's when the desperation kicks in. So I didn't really have any of that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess after that 2 year period, what were the steps you took from making it yourself with your own two hands at home, and then eventually moving out to some form of commercial kitchen, outsourcing the formula that you essentially developed while maintaining quality, and then ultimately distribution? And saying that is exhausting. So walk me through how that took place.
Yeah. It was a slow process, to be honest. I mean, because as I said, because I was in my parents' home making kombucha for the first 2 years. And by the way, because we're talking 1995, there wasn't a Whole Foods. There wasn't any real significant market that was asking and needing these types of products. Back then, here in Los Angeles, by the way, which is always ahead of most parts of the country and even the world, you had probably 5 stores that you could sell to, right? And so what I did is I was very thoughtful and very cautiously optimistic about how I grew my business. So I went from one store, which is Air One, and stayed in that store for about 6 to 9 months and just exclusively sold there. And I would sample, which is, you know, demoing and all that. And I would use this intimate relationship with Air One, which was and is the pioneer health food store in Los Angeles, to really gain knowledge. You know, what are the words that my consumers resonate with? What are, you know, the things that are important to them, you know, things of that nature. And of course, I was also refining the fermentation of my kombucha in the process, because making kombucha is nowhere near like making a soda. In many ways, it's more like cultivating a crop, right? So you have seasonalities, you have natural variations and so forth. So it really was, again, being very slow and cautious and almost, again, somewhat resistant to growth, because a lot of times I associated growth with an opportunity to lose control of quality. And because quality was and is always king to me, I didn't want that to be a risk. So, I mean, it was a slow journey of going from 1 stores to 2 stores to 3 stores to 4 stores to 5 stores. And that honestly was within the first 2 or 3 years. And the only reason why I actually was, and I call it forced, to get a commercial facility, which meant that I moved my production out of my parents' home, is because my parents are going through a breakup. And as silly as it sounds, the first thing that rushed through my mind when I heard they were breaking up was not like, oh no, my parents no longer love each other. I was like, shit, what am I going to do about my kombucha production? So that was the, you know, again, what motivated me and incentivized me to get a commercial facility. And then once I did that, the multiple doors started to open up, because I no longer had the confinements that I mentioned of making it out of my parents' home.
So, wow, a couple of things to touch on there. I want to focus on kombucha education, if you will. So you mentioned something in that snippet where you said that you were essentially enabling customers to sample the product. That's very interesting to me, because this is the late 90s. Like I mentioned before, kombucha was not a thing back then. You mentioned Whole Foods wasn't necessarily a thing in Los Angeles and at the time. And to a certain degree, this whole health wave was definitely not it was definitely not mainstream at all. And so when you're branding this product, and I'm not just referring to the logo, et cetera, but the actual function, the actual health benefits, unlike drinking, let's say, a pop or even an unsweetened iced tea, where you can say, well, let's use an unsweetened iced tea as an example. Like, this tastes good. There's no sugar, but there we go. That the branding ends there. There's a whole other sentence with kombucha, which is, and it makes you feel good, and there are these sorts of health benefits. However, if you're leaning to, there's a stereotype, right? If you're leaning too much into the health benefits, you start to think of it like a medicine, and your preconceived notion in regards to a medicine is negative. I would assume it's negative for me. However, if you lean too far into the direction of this is a drink that may not taste as similar to a Coke per se, but it's far better for you, and the taste grows on you, etc. Like, that's not doing the drink justice. So how do you balance that? How do you balance those two sides of this equation? Because it's that consumer branding that would essentially allow you to scale and allow you to brand kombucha as something that isn't foreign and something that not only tastes good, but has all sorts of benefits. Coming up on the show, I continue my conversation with GT Dave. We'll be right back after this. Stay with us. This is The Ones Who Succeed. Welcome back. How do you balance those two sides of this equation? Because it's that consumer branding that would essentially allow you to scale and allow you to brand kombucha as something that isn't foreign and something that not only tastes good, but has all sorts of benefits.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, I think what you just stated is, how did I connect with the consumer? And, what I identified then, and honestly, even to this day, is that a lot of brands spend a lot of time and a lot of energy kind of bragging about this new and exciting technology or this new and exciting version of a food. So whether that's, cold brew coffee, or whether that's, keto, like, these are all new things that really didn't exist previously. And so that's kind of the sales pitch, right? Is this is new, this is exciting, this has never been seen before. But that conversation, I've learned, can only take you so far, because new today is old tomorrow. So what I decided to do, and this continues to be our path, is that what makes kombucha special is that it's not new. In fact, it's ancient, and it's been consumed for hundreds, if not thousands of years, by people that didn't have access to science, certainly didn't have access to the internet, but somehow, some way, collectively, they all decided that this made them feel great and witnessed the improvements, the health benefits that kombucha brought them, which is why it's been consumed for thousands of years. So that was really my angle. Is I wasn't, I'm very cautious about never selling snake oil. And snake oil is really like, this cures everything. This never seen before. This is brand new. And I think, speaking from, firsthand experience, that when you take that position, it's so suspect. But when you really say, hey, like, this isn't new, this is like an ancient tradition. This is what cultures that have existed long before we have, which have answers to a lot of questions that we don't have, this is their answer. And so when I took that angle, and then of course layered over, and this was something that's not lost on me, was certainly a blessing in disguise, but being able to lay over my mother's story on top of that, right? It's like, I would start with kombucha is this ancient fermented tea that, originated in Manchuria and helped people live into their hundreds. And it helps boost immunity and support digestion, all those things that, by the way, you don't have to take my word for it. There were now books and articles and reports that were generated saying this thing. So I also had that to reference. I wasn't just this one man show pulling a rabbit out of a hat. And then I was able to, again, layer over then my personal story, which is, rather, A, my mother, who I witnessed drinking this for the course of 2 years, and then ultimately have it be this dramatic improvement in her health, and or my own personal story of like, hey, I'm just a teenager, and teenagers are supposed to be invincible. But even from my own personal experience, I noticed that kombucha made me feel great. So I think the long of the short of that statement is, my angle was to always personalize kombucha, make it feel like something that's not recreational. I think what you said about it being a medicine, I never took that angle, but I certainly said it's medicinal. And, you know, that's it's a delicate word to utilize, but in my mind, it's really saying to people like, hey, this is not candy. This is not soda. This is not just a treat. This is something that's like working out. Like, you know, there in the word working, words working out, there's working, it's work, right? So, but you do it and you make it a daily practice and then you become addicted to it because not only does it make you feel great, but it makes you look great. And kombucha and other health foods are honestly exactly the same kind of proposition. So that was the angle that I took and I continue to take.
If you're telling your mother's story in the sales pitch, which is incredible marketing material because it's not fabricated, it's real, and thus, and why wouldn't you tell it? How do you balance the line between this snake oil, too good to be true, and you get into dangerous territory if you're saying, this is kombucha, it's, you know, indirectly or directly helped my mother, and it might do the same for you, or it might not. Like essentially, if you're using the word medicinal, I'm sure that is a fine line.
It certainly is. And again, make no mistake, I am not and have never said that kombucha cured my mom of her cancer. So I think the question you're asking is, how did I dance around sharing my story and the circumstances of my relationship with kombucha without over-promising or worse yet, making claims that could get me into legal hot water? So, the answer is pretty simple. It's really speak from the heart and storytell, right? My mother's story is what it is, right? Like everything that I shared with you, I'm not making up. I'm retelling circumstances that transpired of my mother and father making it and drinking it, what they heard about it, their initial health benefits, my mother's diagnosis, the bleakness of it, the 180 that the doctors gave us, her improvement in her health. I mean, I was able, what I didn't share earlier is I even was able to personally witness that when my mother went through chemotherapy, that the only thing she could consume was kombucha. And the doctors even told her that, hey, you look the best than any other chemotherapy patient we've ever had. And we're blown away by how incredibly strong your body's staying throughout this very, very debilitating process. So in any event, what I'm saying is I would share these stories and they weren't laced with ulterior motives. They weren't laced with trying to pull the wool over people's eyes. I was just saying, hey, this is my story. Take it for what it's worth. But oh, by the way, there, as I said a second ago, there are books, articles, and reports that talk about kombucha and its history, right? I wasn't there in 221 BC when it was first consumed. So there's something there that's beyond what I can share about my story. And then in addition, and this was the last kind of point that I would make, and I'd say, and oh, by the way, this is nothing new. Like fermented foods, whether it's apple cider vinegar, yogurt, kefir, kimchi, miso, fill in the blank. Like these are all things that I think we all understand. Cultures that are much more sophisticated and ancient than us, and again, subscribe to more of a nature world and less of this man-made process world that unfortunately the US still remains pretty dominant in, they seem to get it. So I'm just, again, serving up another opportunity to participate in nature's crafted foods. And that's it. And it, you know, I can't say that 100% of people understood that sales pitch, but I'm pleased to say most people did.
Well, I think that's a great way to put it. And that's ultimately I think that's where it doesn't become snake oil. The number one killer point is, and I didn't invent this because snake oil was invented, right? And I think that's a beautiful way to put it. And it totally makes sense. And the fact that you not only did you not invent it, but here are a bunch of other people who are interested in, and as kombucha caught on and became part of culture, I think the sales pitch just became stronger and stronger inherently.
Yeah.
So talk me through the beverage industry, because if I had to pick one of the most competitive industries, I think I would pick the beverage industry because it feels like almost like tech. Everyone has an idea for something, some cool drink, etc. But unlike tech, there are real gatekeepers, right? So you can get into these small local stores in your region, but to get into a grocery chain like Whole Foods or to get into a grocery chain internationally, it's difficult. It's very difficult. There is someone who ultimately has to make that decision. And so your job is really, you have to win over the gatekeeper. So walk me through kind of that expansion process, because I would imagine that even back then, or especially back then, the beverage industry was quite cutthroat.
You know, you bring up a great point, and I'm actually going to give you an answer that may surprise you, is that, you know, back in the 90s and even up to about 2010, when it came to beverages, you really had two very dramatic worlds that were separate and didn't interact and therefore didn't compete with each other. And so you had the world that I lived in, which is the natural food world, which, you know, took pride in being quirky and took pride in incorporating unusual ingredients and unusual flavor profiles into their beverage and unusual use occasions, right? And that primarily existed in the natural food marketplace, which was Whole Foods, which was really the pinnacle of all of that. And then everybody below Whole Foods, which is your small regional chains, your independent mom and pops, things of that nature. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you had the second world, which was the kind of conventional beverage industry, which was and is dominated by Coke, Pepsi, and things of that nature. And they would look at the natural world and be like, almost like a senior in high school,
yeah,
or
yeah,
even like someone in college looking at like somebody in kindergarten and being like, oh, that's cute. Look what they're doing. That's really sweet. I wonder where that will go. Oh, look, they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's so cool. Like, again, it was very dismissive and they'd really discount what we were doing, because they knew, and this was true, that almost nobody, with the exception of vitamin water, which was one of the first phenomenons, crossed over from natural to conventional and really became a threat. And then, of course, what happens is Coke bought vitamin water. Yeah, so that's right. How that story went. So again, it actually wasn't competitive, which is something that I loved. And it's something that in many ways I miss, because again, in the natural food world, being everything that I just described, in addition to that, it was very, very heartfelt. And so even though there was another kombucha company or another fermented beverage company or another just health drink that I would share the shelf with, we kind of had this unspoken love for each other, because we were like, you know, again, stewards of nature, trying to make the world a better place, trying to expose people to an alternative way of living and drinking and eating. So we were it was very amicable competition. Now cut to, so in 2010 to about 2015 is when you started to see this slow shift. And in my mind, there was really two things that caused it. One was you had the economic downturn in 2008 here in the US, which virtually every industry, food or otherwise, took a nosedive. But one of the few things it didn't was the natural food kind of channel and industry. Like Whole Foods was still growing. People, you know, were starting to stop spending money on indulgent things and putting it into food, and, you know, health and wellness became more of a thing because of social media. So you start to see that shift. And then what that opened the eyes of is the conventional retailers like Safeway and Kroger, which are the two main national retailers here in the US. They started picking up products like mine. And then that's what pushed the small little niche category of natural food products like mine into a conventional setting. And then now cut two is the competition that you just referenced, which is what we go through today.
So when you are talking to the gatekeepers at Safeway and Whole Foods and every grocery chain that you're in now, what was the sales pitch and what was the reception that you received?
Well, it's really interesting. I can paint two very dramatic pictures of then versus now. So, you know, then it was our phone ringing, our door being knocked on, them asking us, hey, you know, when can you start selling your products to us? Because as I mentioned, in 2010 is when Safeway woke up and said, hey, we're not only we're going to intentionally put these products in our stores, but we're going to lower the barrier for them to come in. Like, we're going to actually put ourselves behind them. We're really going to support them. And so that, from that, you got Safeway, Kroger, Costco, Walmart, Target. So all these massive retailers here in the US all contacted me and my company and said, hey, we heard about you. We want to put you on our shelves. And, you know, we're going to walk you through this process. So now cut to today, you know, fortunately, it's still a lot of that for a brand like mine, because we're still very popular. It doesn't happen as often, because fortunately or unfortunately, we're in every single retailer. So there's really not a retailer that could knock on our door that we haven't already talked to or currently aren't working with. But you're noticing a behavioral change with these buyers is that now they're a little jaded. I think they're a little calloused because, like, again, those conversations of what kombucha is and what it does, you would a lot of times see these buyers go, oh my God, that's amazing. I'll take a truckload, right? Versus now they say, oh, that's great, but how does it compare to so-and-so? And how does it compare to keto? And how does it compare to Whole 30? And how does it compare to this product? And, you know, and because there's so many brands trying to force themselves on the shelves, it's really more of a buyer's market now, which means that the buyer's like, yeah, let me think about it. I won't take six of your six flavors. I'll take three of your six, and I want what's called a free fill, which is I want you to fill my shelves for free. So the negotiation strength is really on the buyer's side because, as we know, it's a combination of supply and demand. And currently there's just way more supply of these latest and greatest fill in the blank type of health and wellness beverages than there were ever before. So, and by the way, not everything that sparkles is gold. So buyers have also seen that some of these brands have come in with these huge promises and then only fall flat on their face 6 months later. So buyers are very apprehensive. So you really have to do the hard sell, put your best foot forward, and get ready to strike a pretty aggressive deal.
GT's currently controls around roughly 40% of the US kombucha market, which is insane. But since you were really early on to this wave, you've seen the evolution, like you just described, of this health and wellness drink market evolve. And as a result, not everyone entering the space might share your ideology in regards to prioritizing quality at all costs. And you see, just quite frankly, there are a ton of not so great products out there. And as a result, I'm curious to hear your perspective on this because you are very much partly responsible for the kombucha boom in North America. Does it bother you that there are a ton of competitors? And, you know, ultimately, if you have a bad experience with the kombucha drink, it kind of upsets one person's perspective for all sorts of brands, even though it's not yours. All right, we're going to take one last quick break and we'll be right back with GT Dave. That's all ahead on The Ones Who Succeed. Stay with us. You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed. Welcome back. Not everyone entering the space might share your ideology in regards to prioritizing quality at all costs. And you see, just quite frankly, there are a ton of not so great products out there. And as a result, I'm curious to hear your perspective on this because you are very much partly responsible for the kombucha boom in North America. Does it bother you that there are a ton of competitors? And, you know, ultimately, if you have a bad experience with the kombucha drink, it kind of upsets one person's perspective for all sorts of brands, even though it's not yours.
Yes. I mean, I can't say that it bothers me that there are other brands or competitors in the space, because as I said earlier, I really do think that we're all working towards a common goal of trying to improve people's health, get them off of soda, get them off of things that aren't very healthy for them. Having said that, what is a little bit of a pain point for me is what I've now seen the why these companies are making kombucha. So in the past, and I would say like maybe 5-10 years ago, everybody making kombucha was genuinely somebody that was in love with kombucha, in love with it, in love with what it meant and stood for, and really wanted to participate in that conversation. Unfortunately, in the last 5 or so years, that conversation and position has changed, where it really is more of an opportunistic play. So whether that's the Cokes and the Pepsis that are now involved and participating in the category, or even Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors and all these other big, big companies that, you know, honestly, probably don't even know or care what kombucha is. They just know that it's popular and it sells well. So they have all added these products to their portfolio. But where the bad comes is through that somewhat half-hearted relationship with kombucha, right? It's a little bit more opportunistic and less genuine. You start to see that in the products that are hitting the market or in the market. So a lot of them are barely fermented, arguably fermented, very watered down, processed in some way, whether that's pasteurized or hyper-filtered, now shelf stable, they're in cans. They're, you know, it's all these different versions, which I'm not upset about that, because I think variety is the spice of life. And I think it's certainly good for the consumer to have options. But I think where the slippery slope is we can't all be saying this is the same kind of kombucha, because right. we know it's not. And
well, you know it's not.
Yeah, we know it's not. And our right. job is to help the consumer know it's not. Because as I said earlier, like, I didn't get started making kombucha because I thought I was going to get rich. I didn't start making kombucha because I thought it was the best tasting thing on the planet. I started making kombucha because I wanted it to help people, and I wanted to be the protector of that. And in many ways, I still am, in a different way. Now, instead of protecting it from my batch to batch process, I'm certainly still doing that. But in addition to that, I'm trying to protect the actual category, because, you know, I'm truly fearful that if we're not careful, what's going to stop kombucha from becoming a, you know, cold brew coffee or a cold pressed juice or a coconut water, which if you're familiar with those categories, they all kind of don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, they're diluted.
Yeah, they're quite diluted literally. and they're bastardized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want that to happen on my watch. So that's kind of the wrestle I have with the current state of the industry, is like, I want to see it grow, but I want to see it grow in a sustainable way.
All right. So are you, with that said, are you friendly with fellow kombucha competitors whose values you share?
Yes, I am very friendly, to the point where, like, I don't know if you know this, but recently at the tail end or middle of February, we celebrated our second annual World Kombucha Day. And I use that as an opportunity to not make it about myself, but in many ways shine a bright light on, you know, the history of kombucha, as well as the beautiful people behind kombucha. So I actually interviewed about five kombucha brewers throughout the world, not just here in the US. And it was a great way to celebrate our affinity and love affair for kombucha and the why, you know, why we've done this and why we're doing this.
Mm-hmm. I have a few more questions here, especially in regards to the fundamentals behind GTs, which essentially comes down to surfing this kombucha wave quite well. I mean, you've been at this for a while. So obviously in the late 90s, the kombucha was nothing compared to, you know, what it is today. But today it's certainly something. And throughout that period of time, like, I think of business as these basically waves. And if you can surf the waves, then obviously that certainly helps with growth. Was this a conscious effort? I think I know the answer to this, but I'm still going to ask it. Was it a conscious effort in terms of this kombucha surfing wave, or was this just timed really well and that wasn't intentional and you were just at this for a while and then all of a sudden, I think definitely in kind of the mid to late 2000s, the wave started to get bigger?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I never saw it as a wave because, you know, I was raised a vegetarian. I was raised on the importance of, and even, you know, going out a step further, even the spiritualness of food. So kombucha was a representative of that. And so in my mind, you know, the closest I can get to calling it a wave is it, in my mind, it was a wave of consciousness. And I think that consciousness supports a certain way of living and eating. And so in my mind, I knew from the way I was raised that this is ultimately where people's consciousness should end up. So, you know, I'm arguably ahead of where the current movement is, but I'm heading in the right direction, perhaps at a different speed or a different pace than most people are, but at some point they'll catch up. Because listen, it's not rocket science. Health is wealth, right? The healthier you are, the happier you are. We're human beings, we're all pursuing happiness. And so I knew that this very simple expression and participation in making something like kombucha that does everything that it does, that, yeah, I'd have some barriers in front of me of the ignorance that perhaps is out there of these types of foods, but ultimately there was going to be this aha moment that people would eventually have. And I witnessed it firsthand how it happens, sometimes immediately or sometimes delayed, but it always happens. Because, and this is my last point, is that I knew, and I still know, how I felt when my mother was diagnosed with cancer, right? And I knew then and know now that almost everybody, especially in this country, can speak to what it feels like to have someone they know, someone they love, or worse yet, themselves, diagnosed with a disease. And so the root of disease, which is, I was always raised this way, it's when you're not taking care of your body, right? You're giving it impurities and toxins and things that aren't nutrients that will ultimately break it, right? And so I knew that just the fact that I was promoting something that's healthy, that I was, you know, as they say, doing God's work. And that's what really became and is my driving force. And that's why I always knew that there was no wave to catch, because waves come and go. This is like the ocean. I am surfing the ocean. I'm not surfing some kind of fleeting moment.
Well put. A few more questions here before we wrap up, and you've been so generous with your time, so I appreciate it. On the outside, you have built quite a nice personal brand just for yourself. And that's arguably quite tied to the company because your name GT is the name of essentially your business, GT's Living Foods. And as a result, I'm curious if this was a conscious effort after the company started to take on a life of its own. You're still running it, but obviously the operations, I would assume, are quite different from the early days. So in terms of this brand building, talk a little bit about that. If this was something that was intentional, is this a conscious effort?
I would say yes to both, right? So it's certainly intentional. It's certainly conscious. It's not calculated though, which I know is a fine line. So, you know, I'm going to use a kind of a silly analogy, but it's the best way that I think answer your question is that there's raising a brand and then there's raising a living thing. And they're similar yet different. You know, I think a lot of times brands have to pick one path, one tone, one profile, because I think brand, classically trained brand marketers are like, hey, it just has to be on brand. It has to be consistent. You know, you have to pick one thing and that's your thing, which I certainly think is important. And I certainly pay attention to and believe in to a certain degree. But then on the flip side, where you have the raising a living thing, right? It's almost like this living, breathing, has a personality, you know, stands for something, you know, emulates that of a human being, where you have different like sides to your personality and different moods, and you grow up, right? So who you are when you're a child is different than who you are when you're, you know, a teenager versus who you are when a young adult, and so forth and so forth. So that's really how I've always raised my brand, right? I see myself as a parent, right? Gave birth to this product. It has my DNA and genetic influence, no matter how, you know, weird that sounds. It really is an extension of me, from what's in the bottle to what's on the bottle, to how the product and brand expresses itself. So again, utilizing more of this raising a living thing approach, which is certainly what I do, is I allow it to evolve. But just like raising a human being and a child, you really want it to be a good person, right? And you want it to, you know, make good friendships and, you know, fall in love and have a life of its own. And that's really what I do with my products, is I feel that if I put them on a very somewhat straight and narrow path, and I don't force it into this mainstream world, and I allow them to grow and evolve in a very thoughtful way, that they have and will continue to grow up into these living things that I'm really proud of.
It's a wonderful way to frame it. If you were to start from scratch today, and this is an interesting one because you're very much tied to kombucha. So let's just say kombucha is here. And so you were not, someone else controlled 40% of the market. I guess the question is, would you build another company? And if so, what steps would you take to build another company? What industry would it be?
Yeah. I mean, here, I've said this before. It's no mistake why I named my company GT's Living Foods instead of GT's Kombucha, right? And although you could argue they're not much different, they really are. Because if I was to name my company GT's Kombucha, I am essentially saying to myself and everybody else, I am a kombucha company and that's all I am. But because I the name of the company is Living Foods, kombucha is a family member of the Living Foods family, but it's not the only thing. And so I think to answer your question simply is absolutely. If like kombucha was what it is today and everything that you said existed, number one, I would absolutely, and I'm saying this to all wannabe producers out there right now, I would absolutely positively not get into the kombucha space, because that is like the proverbial me too copycat, you know, zero innovation, because like that ship is sailed, that box is checked. The world needs another kombucha brand like it needs a hole in the head. So I would not do that. But to your question, what I would do is I'd certainly, because they're there, I'd certainly identify something like kombucha, which is something that embodies nature's beauty, nature's medicine, nature's healing properties, and find a way to take that, whether it's in the marketplace in a bad form or not at all, and take it and create an authentic, genuine, pure and potent version of that. So like right now, honestly, like something that I'm personally passionate about is cannabis. And as that may ring certain alarm bells to people listening, not in Canada. Yeah. But just in the world, you know, there's some people that think cannabis is a drug and it's messed up people's lives and so forth. And I think there's aspects of that that are true, but I think you could say that about a lot of things. But you know, cannabis is a plant-based medicine, and it's an example, certainly not the only one, of what is still out there in the world that we rather know and have mislabeled and misbranded and demonized, or that we don't know, or people don't want us to know, like the pharmaceutical industry. So back to your question. So absolutely, I would find something that's like a kombucha and put my heart and soul behind it and do exactly what I've done with kombucha.
What's next for GT's Living Foods on that note?
Great question. So that's my answer was a perfect segue into that statement, is that because we are Living Foods and we're not a kombucha company exclusively, you know, we stand for foods that are living, provide life, make people feel happier and healthier. And again, kombucha certainly does that, but it's not the only thing. So in addition to kombucha, we have a product called Alive, which is sold in Canada. It's a mushroom adaptogenic elixir. So we take reishi, chaga, and turkey tail, which we believe are one of the three most potent medicinal mushrooms. And we do a very intense extraction here in our facilities in Los Angeles. And we create a low sugar, very, what we like to believe, tasty and sparkling beverage. It has the nutrients of these medicinal mushrooms, which I believe medicinal mushrooms are basically where kombucha was 25 years ago. In addition to that, we have a water kefir called aqua kefir, which is what we call kombucha's little sister, which means it has all the similar backgrounds of kombucha, like came from certain cultures and certain countries, and it was believed to have medicinal properties, but it's much younger. It's only 200 years old. And then last but not least, and I won't bore you with the others, but we have a raw coconut.
No, please.
We have a raw coconut yogurt, which is exquisite. It's in, and obviously I'm biased, but it's the purest, most potent yogurt in the world, to my knowledge. We have these shots coming out, which are called immortal shots, which do everything from boost your beauty, your immunity, as well as your digestion. So yes, we have a couple things up our sleeves or already in the marketplace.
So you're busy.
Yeah, I can say I'm busy.
GT Dave, you've been so generous with your time. Great to get to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
That's GT Dave, one of the ones who succeed. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show, it would be amazing if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. Or why not tell a friend? That also helps new listeners discover the show. I really appreciate it. As for me, I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Campbell J. Barron. All right, you've made it to the end of the show. Thanks for listening. I'm Campbell Barron, and I'll be back next week.